Thank you. Okay, we'll go ahead and convene the Finance Committee now, please. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. The first order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes from January 25th, 2012 meeting, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval?
So moved.
Commissioner Scott?
Second.
Commissioner Jones? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Committee item number one, financial overview. Mr. Jensen, would you please make your presentation?
Good afternoon, Commissioners. My name is Mike Jensen. I'm the Division Director for Administrative Resources. I have about five slides to give you a high-level summary overview of our revenue and our budget. The first slide I wanted to touch upon are just the highlights on Fund 9 and 64 that are noteworthy in the news right now. After an exhaustive search and a competitive solicitation for a replacement to the Verizon vendor for a license sale system for hunting and fishing licenses, we narrowed it down to a short list of three vendors. About a week and a half ago, we did select and a contract was signed with Gordon Darby Incorporation. They are a private company in Kentucky, and they currently have a large contract with TCEQ, which is high volume transactional data for the emissions testing system. I think this is a favorable best value opportunity for the state. They were actually the lower price, and it appears after the evaluation that they're providing the most mature development team. So I think we're in good hands. And this is going to be under development between now and it needs to go live August 15th, 2013 or sooner. So I think we're in good shape with the selection that we've made. On Fund 64 in the news, last commission meeting we talked about the $4.6 million hole in the state park account. There was a release on March 22nd from Communications Division that we've achieved about $1.4 million in donations, and about 1.17 of that can be attributed to the public appeal. Then we have about $230,000 that are directly related to donors who opt in when they register their vehicles. That's about $185,000, but that was legislatively mandated of DMV to do that. At the same time, the department also implemented in the BRITS, that's the boat registration titling system, an opportunity for folks to donate there as well. And since that's been implemented for about a month and a half, 2 months now, those folks who are registering their boats have actually donated $42,000 through that avenue as well. And that's very good. That's higher than I had anticipated, so it's looking very good. I'm going to move on to the next slide, state park receipts. On this slide, you can see a bunch of red, but I'd like to point out that last fiscal year, when we began last fiscal year, the first 6 months were very strong. They were probably the strongest 6 months period starting a fiscal year in the past 7 to 10 years. So we're comparing a decent performance against an exceptional performance. That's why we're sort of trailing and tracking behind. We're hopeful that with the rain and there are no more burn bans, so families can take their kids out, they can cook in a park, and there's water now. There's more water in some places than others, so hopefully there's enough to fish in the state parks to have that opportunity. But if you look at the facilities, we are down about 7.5%.
Yeah.
Entrance fees are down slightly 3%. Concessions are down 7.3%, and park passes are down. But we believe that if we have a strong summer, that we can show something in the black. But the reality is, with what our appropriations bill says, Rider 27, that we pre-budgeted the $3 million, in order to just meet the comptroller estimate, we would have to exceed 2011 by approximately 5%. In order to bring additional revenues with appropriation authority into the department, we'd have to do better than 5% over 2011. I think it's optimistic to hope for that, but I'm an optimist. I'm hoping that we may not get $3 million, but it would be great if the department could collect something and get authority from the comptroller's office to move forward in 64. On the boat revenue compared to last year, this number is positive in aggregate, 2.8%. We're up $164,000 compared to the same period last year. But if you compare this to our baseline year, we're actually about 6% behind the levels of 2008. But this is just the beginning of the boat registration season. With the rain that we've had, we're optimistic that this 2.8 is going to be a better number when we convene in May. If you look at the counts down below, you can see that the rain is encouraging some folks to go out and register their boats that may have lapsed a year because of the drought last summer. A lot of people did not register their boats. So we're optimistic that this is going to improve as well before we come to the next commission meeting. On the license revenue comparison, if you look through each category, we're down other than non-resident fishing licenses. The biggest opportunity that the department has at this point in time is the resident fishing licenses. And if you look at the number, that's where the largest variance is. About $2 million of the hole that we have compared to this period last year is in fishing licenses. So if this rain holds up, lakes fill up, hopefully people will go out and go fishing, and they'll buy that license before they go fishing. I've kind of highlighted with Carter and others the combination, but really that combination deficit there, it only accounts for approximately about $600,000 of the hull, but that's a $600,000 we're probably not going to fill back in because most folks buy their combination license before January. So we anticipate and hope that fishing's going to improve and that these numbers will improve as we go to the next commission meeting and as we wind down this fiscal year.
Just to build on what Mike said, I mean, we're not just taking that for granted. Obviously, there's nothing we can do about the rain and the water and the runoff into lakes, but you know, our marketing team is pushing very, very hard to get people out to fish, helping to tell that story and encourage folks to get outside. So that's a big push for us right now. The only thing we have an opportunity to probably impact vis-a-vis licenses. Most hunting licenses are already sold, save and except a few, you know, folks that are going turkey hunting that hadn't bought licenses up to now. So that, coupled with our state parks, are the big push right now from a marketing communication perspective.
And the last slide for this overview presentation is the budget adjustments. As of November, we had $404 million in the budget, the operating budget. We've had some adjustments since then. And through the end of February, we've added $6.2 million of federal grants. We've added $3.19 million of other appropriated receipts and interagency contracts. Out of that amount, about $1.2 million is related to border security. Then we have about $830,000 related to artificial reef. And the other appropriated receipts also include some of the donations that have come in for state parks, including the Meadows Foundation donation. That's in there as well. And there are a few other donations in there. Then we have some additional Rider 4 and some construction UB that has been added to the budget and fringe benefits of $260,000. So the adjustment amount is $9.8 million. Our adjusted budget through the end of February is $414.34 million. I know that was quick. That's a very high-level overview of the budget adjustments and the revenue streams. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you might have.
Yes, sir.
Back on your license revenue comparison, where do you include the lifetime hunting license purchase?
The lifetime license falls under the miscellaneous category. When those revenues come in, they don't go into Fund 9. Fund 9 is the Game, Fish, and Water Safety account. When we sell a lifetime license, it goes into an endowment fund. So the agency does have a limited appropriation authority for some of that interest that goes to the Wildlife Division budget, about $840,000. But it falls within the miscellaneous category.
Okay.
If I showed you a slide on count, it's because we haven't had a fee increase. We had a fee increase about 3 years ago, and you could really see the spike. Everybody went out and bought them before the price went up, mm-hmm. and that cycle has gone through. So they're pretty steady right now, so it doesn't really throw the numbers off. It doesn't throw the revenue off either. It's really a small percentage of the total licenses available.
Increase the fees again.
Talk with Gene McCarty and talk with Carter and talk with your colleagues here.
I think that's one way to pass that ball.
You're going to get the look.
Anything else, Mike?
No, sir.
Thank you for your presentation. Any other questions, comments, discussion? We're okay? All right. Thank you. There's no further action required on this then. Committee item number 2, historically underutilized business compliance. Mr. Mike Jensen again. Are you going to make that presentation?
I'm going to present, but I'd like to invite Tammy Dunham to come up and answer all the hard questions if you have them, because she'll be better equipped to do that than I am. Tammy Dunham is the department's hub coordinator. So I'm going to go ahead and flip to this slide here. What is the Texas Hub Program? The Texas Hub Program is defined in Texas statute. It's a gender-conscious and race-conscious program. Basically, if you're a woman or if you're Asian Pacific, Native American, Black, or Hispanic business, there is a certification process that the state has set up that allows them to be designated an historically underutilized business. And the Comptroller's Office is charged to oversee that program. And their vision is anybody who meets those criteria, they're hoping that they can get them certified and to be part of that population for state solicitations. And their philosophy is we need to do everything that we can as public entities for the state to reach out and give these hub businesses a fair opportunity to compete and to increase their participation and hopefully increase their share of contract awards. That's their goal. And this is different than a federal program. Commissioner Falcone had that question of me earlier. The federal program is more of an affirmative action type program. The state's program is not. The state's program is based upon a disparity study. That disparity study provides the legal foundation. And I have a couple slides, and I'll admit I did sort of gear this towards the commissioners who went to law school. I have a couple slides on this. And because this is a race-conscious and a gender-conscious program, if it were to ever be challenged, the Comptroller's Office, who did the disparity study, wanted to make sure that whatever program we had would pass muster, which would mean it would pass the strict scrutiny based upon a higher level of scrutiny in judicial review than intermediate scrutiny of gender. So in 1994, the genesis of this program was after a disparity study that was performed by a group called NERA. And that study was very limited in scope. And in 2009, a renewed study was done. And in both studies, they have found statistical and anecdotal evidence sufficient to justify and to continue the hub program. They did make recommendations in the 2009 study, but I want to kind of differentiate the 94 from the 2009 study. The 1994 study was much smaller in scope. It only involved 7 agencies, and they really focused on TxDOT and their regional purchasing units. So the goals that they created back in 1994 were more tailored towards the spend from a TxDOT perspective than from a state perspective. That study did identify disparity and did establish aspirational goals, but it made no recommendations other than setting aspirational goals. It didn't make any recommendations to make this an affirmative action program or anything of that sort. So from 1994 through about 2009, the state operated with that as the legal foundation, the analysis, until they conducted a new study. The comptroller hired a PhD in very strong quantitative statistical analysis to be the manager for the state. They hired MGT of America to conduct a study. It was a 3-year study. The data that they used for this study, the current study, included data from all state agencies, not just 7. It included data from most of the institutions of higher education that received appropriations from the Appropriation Act. It was a very extensive report, had 10 chapters. One of the chapters is about all the case law, constitutional law, Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And it provided 16 recommendations to the state. And since that has been published, the Comptroller's Office has made some rule changes to the program. And ultimately, it boils down to this study says there is a reason for this program. There's a reason to support this program based upon statistical and anecdotal evidence. And based upon the recommendations that they've put into rule, they believe that this program should continue, that it serves a valid public purpose. The enabling statute is Texas Government Code 2161, and there is an exhaustive list of rules on how to administer the program. That was recently changed about 4 years ago to the Comptroller section of the Administrative Code, and I'm only going to touch upon 2 of those real quickly. One of the significant rules that we deal with most of our major contracts, and we consider anything over $100,000 to be significant, is a requirement for vendors when they submit a bid or proposal to reach out to hubs to give them an opportunity if they're subcontracting opportunities. And the lingo is that's a hub subcontracting plan. People call that an HSP. And the rule prescribes what a vendor needs to do in order to demonstrate a good faith effort. And that's one of the rule changes that was significant. It used to be a less number of days, but now they have to contact a minimum of 3 hubs and give them 7 days to respond to them. It doesn't mean they're going to get the business. They just have to give them an opportunity so the hubs know that these opportunities are out there. They also have to contact the trade organization and give them 7 days. And the reason I bring that to your attention is failure to meet those minimum requirements in the rule is failure to be responsive. So if somebody does not meet the minimum steps in the rule, we cannot consider their proposal. We can't award. Basically, we shouldn't even read their proposal at that point in time. And that can be problematic. That could be deemed a gotcha in the world of procurement. So we do our best to try to educate and provide information before solicitations close so that vendors can meet these criteria. The second one here that's of importance to our agency is delegated purchases. Most state agencies operate through delegation. The comptroller cannot possibly do everybody's procurement for them. About 3 years ago, the comptroller's office, the term contracts that all state agencies are required to use, they went to no spot limits, which made it really difficult because a lot of our operations are fairly rural, and it just posed shipping and handling difficulties. So we actually proactively went and discussed with them, and they agreed to give Parks and Wildlife some reasonable, justifiable spot limits. And what we committed to as a department is, as we do these spot limits, granted it's smaller dollar amounts, but it's high volume, we will do our best to promote and support the hub program with our delegated purchases when we use our procurement cards and when we don't use the term contracts. How does this impact our agency? Well, basically, if you see our one single rule in Parks and Wildlife and our rules, it incorporates by reference all the comptroller's rules. Our agency is not responsible for going out and identifying hub businesses and pushing them through the certification process. We don't have staff do that. The comptroller does that. They do extensive outreach. They invite people to participate and to fill out the paperwork and become certified, and they manage that data set, and we use that data set when we do procurements. Our responsibility is to actively use that data set, to use the centralized master bidders list, and to use the hub information, hub directory, for all of our solicitations and all of our procurements. When the disparity study came out, it did modify the aspirational goals on a statewide level, but at the same time, about 4 years ago, there was a government code statute that charged the state auditor's office to look at every state agency to see, did that state agency set agency-specific hub goals, and did that agency meet those hub goals? After the disparity study, we were told to wait until we could consult with the comptroller's office to create parks and wildlife-specific goals. And about 3 or 4 consultations with Dr. Higgigi with the comptroller's office, we actually used the methodology that's published as an appendix in the disparity study to develop agency-specific goals. And those goals were made available in October, and those goals were adhering to a formula that was proposed by the disparity study. It's kind of difficult to summarize, but it focused on the spend of Parks and Wildlife and not the spend of all state agencies. And it also looked at how to remove certain vendors that aren't part of competition. For example, we have interagency contracts with other state agencies, so we remove that out of the equation. And we just focus on the areas where we really spend and the locations where we spend. And there is a method in place to have goals that are achievable and reasonable based upon that formula. And that's what we have now. We're committed to pursuing opportunities to supporting hub businesses, and at this time we don't really have enough information to give you a good status where we are on the goals. We believe that we can do better with the goals that we have. The goals have to be reasonable, have to be achievable, because when the SAO comes to review us, that's what they're going to look at. It's just pass or fail in their audit. And
can we get a copy of those goals?
Yes, sir.
And a report on where we are?
Yes, sir. We'll get that for you.
And can you give the breakdown of what category that the businesses fall into? Women-owned?
We can do that.
And, you know, whatever the various groups are, I'd like to know what those are.
We'll get that for you, and it'll be mapped out.
Okay.
Because that's, in my last slide, that's one of the areas. We were visited by the state auditor's office, and they used a data set that was about from 3 years ago. And the audit was not favorable, but Tammy Dunham wasn't responsible for the program, and neither was I at the time. I was actually at the comptroller's office. I was responsible for oversight at that level. I mean, the hub manager for the statewide program actually reported to me at that point in time. So one of the problems we had when the SAO review was our data collection needed to improve, and we've made improvements. So the report that you're going to get is going to be more accurate. It's going to be a better data set than we've been able to provide in the past. So that's the good thing about the audit review that we had. And another thing from these audits and from the internal audit that followed it, we've actually implemented all the recommendations that the SAO had presented to us. And some of them, in my mind, I hate to say this, I felt were kind of immaterial. They wanted certain things in job description, that sort of thing. The things that we really focused on were the substantive things, but we addressed them all. The substantive thing for me was to have good quality data that an objective third party could replicate and could demonstrate that we are actually doing the best that we can to promote the program. And you can see that through a process, and you can also see that through results. So we have implemented better processes for tracking subcontracting data that's supposed to be reported, and have better tools. And I'd like to mention before I finish that the infrastructure division, Rich McMonagle's division, because of the level of funding we have for construction and bonds, they've done a great job. I mean, the hub program's not just Tammy and a couple of her staff. He has a contracting chief who has very good experience in this area for the city of Austin. And they really take this into mind when they do their solicitations. It's challenging to, because we're still trying to get best value in everything we do, but we also want to support this program. I do want to compliment them, because in the last year and a half or so, the department has done well with respect to actual results, and a lot of that really relates to the presentation that Rich gave y'all at the end of the last meeting 2 months ago. He gave you a report about what they've accomplished, the projects that have been completed. A lot of those completed projects did have hub spend on them, so the agency is doing its part all across. I think Carter and the rest of us will admit that we can do better, especially with the delegated purchases that we have for the small dollars, because we do spend a lot of money on small purchases with credit cards, and we can do better with that respect to that aspect. We'll get that report for each of you.
Yeah, not only can we do better, we will do better. That is our commitment on that. And the hub program and our performance on that is really the purview of every one of us inside this agency that have any responsibility for purchasing. And so this is something that we take very, very seriously. I think, as Mike noted, we've seen some improvements, but we're going to have to continue to see improvements in order for us to perform really, I think, at the level that's expected of us.
If you have any other questions, I'd be happy to try and answer or defer to Tammy, because she knows the details.
I don't have a question. I just want to echo Carter's comment, because I believe it was 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, you and I met with Senator West, and he was reinforced with us how important it was for this agency to step up and do at least what was expected, if not more, and we committed at that time that we were going to do that, and I know this, all of us feel that way, so I'm glad to get this report and want to encourage you to, as Carter said, we will improve and do better so that we can give him a favorable report from time to time on our efforts in this respect.
Well, I was about to say, he talks to me on a fairly regular basis, and so you might want to. Yeah, we will need to do that. We don't want to have to hit that buzzsaw next session.
I didn't give the commitment lightly. I said we'll follow up, and that's why I want to see us encourage us to continue to.
Well, and from previous history, I'm somewhat familiar with some of the effort that is required to do this, and it does take an effort. I'd like to see what we're doing, because I see all of this, but I'd like to see in actual numbers where are we, what are some of our policies that we have in place to do some of those things, and particularly in the construction arena. I know I've seen reports
where when a contractor is considered for a job, there's like a spreadsheet of things that that contractor is weighed on. And one of those things might be, you know, expertise in the field, you know, presentation during the face-to-face meeting. You know, there's all these categories, and one of those is HUB program participation, and everybody is weighed according to all of those things, not just one of them. I don't know if we do anything like that or not, but those are the kinds of things that I'll be looking for just as we go forward, so I just want to understand it and understand what we're doing.
We will get a report for you probably as soon as the end of this week. I mean, we actually have data, but we're looking at the layout of the report. We want it to be as accurate as it possibly can be.
Sure.
So we're changing the layout slightly so that it's more accurate with respect to division by division, because there is a lot of work that goes on construction, and want to make sure everybody understands that infrastructure is partnering with multiple divisions. So it's not a matter of everybody wants the credit, but we're just trying to be more accurate than we've been able to be in the past, and we have that capability now. We have staff trained to do it, so we'll get it to you.
And we had submitted the semi-annual report to the comptroller, so we're waiting for them to certify their numbers. So it should be coming in any day where they actually confirm, so we can confirm the figures.
Okay.
But that should be finalized by next week, I assume.
Okay. Thank you. This morning when we met, I was going to ask you, and I just thought about it again, on the rules for applying as a HUB contractor. Failure to satisfy the minimum requirements is a fatal error. Can you explain that to me a little bit more, and what that means, and how does that compare to anybody else that may apply for it?
I'll give you an example.
Okay.
We have a major hypothetical. We have a major contract such as a license sale system contract, and a vendor, and we tell them we believe that subcontracting opportunities are probable and possible under this, and they don't say they contact two, or they contact three, and one of them is not presently on the HUB direct, they're not certified. If they will submit those plans earlier, we've asked them to do that in some solicitations so that we can give them a review before the closing date. But if they don't avail themselves of that opportunity and they're deficient, if the rule says it has to be three and they only have two, that is a fatal error. I mean, the rule actually says we must treat that as non-responsive. It points us to the government code that tells us that as well. That's why infrastructure, as well as our division, is partnering with the other divisions. If it's a sizable commitment of state funds, we want to get out there with pre-proposal conferences, pre-bidder conferences. And we have a segment on the HUBs of Contracting Plan, and we walk vendors through it, because we don't want someone losing out on business. We don't want to lose out on the opportunity if everything else is good on a best value proposal that we can't even read. And this is one of the areas I think the department as a whole has improved, but this is a concern that we have. This is a concern also that the Comptroller's Office has and other state agencies. And when you work for the Governor's Office, it's a concern you have there. Because it's when it's a black and white rule, and the rule tells you to throw them out, then you have to throw them out.
Yeah, and unfortunately, if you don't mind me, we have to disqualify people who have really good proposals that we can't even look at because they only send it out for 4 days versus a 7-day requirement. The way we've come back on that is now, as soon as the solicitation notification is sent out, one of our HUB program specialists sends out a follow-up email with, here's exactly what we expect you to do. If you need help, here's three contact numbers. We're trying to really be proactive and, you know, holding the hands of the vendors and what can we do to help you. And you know, we'll follow up and we'll come back with them. And then we do the pre-proposals, and then we offer to review every HSP if they want before they submit it. So we're trying to help them as much as we can.
Having been on the other side of this issue, trying to find qualified HUB businesses,
which is really the biggest
problem. It's I think it's come a ways, but 8-9 years ago even, we were up here and doing a lot of stuff Cap Metro, and it was extremely difficult to even find three that were qualified. A lot of times you might just have one that's gone to the effort to get qualified. That's what I was going to bring up, you know, on specific and mundane stuff. I'm sure there's a lot of people that are qualified or certified. But if you run across an instance, you know, if it's a decent-sized procurement and we don't have the necessary qualified people. Y'all need to let, you know, we need, that needs to be addressed, because it is a separate issue. When you don't have a qualified bidder, and you know, and you're sitting there sticking your neck out for a bunch of money, and no comfort level with the person that you're having to be put in bed with, you know, that's something that also needs to be addressed, you know, because that sword bites both ways. So y'all need to always, in my book, you know, I mean, if you run across that situation, hopefully it's gotten far enough down the road now to where there's enough qualified people in every instance to where, you know, you got at least three. But I sure had lots of issues with that for a long time on being able to get enough qualified bidders. So y'all need to let us know if that becomes an issue, because if it needs to be addressed, we need to have more outreach to get these people to go ahead and get qualified. But small business by nature doesn't have all the overhead. They don't have all the people, you know, to fight a mountain of paperwork. So that's why you end up not sometimes having enough qualified businesses. And so we just need to always keep our eye on that, because, once again, we don't want to penalize anybody. The whole idea here is just to help them get qualified. But, you know, when a bid comes out, it's too late to worry about getting qualified.
Yeah. No, it's a great point, Commissioner. And to be fair, we have struggled in that regard. You know, on some of our categories, the universe of eligible hub vendors is not very large. And so trying to help promote the opportunity, do strategic outreach to hub-related vendors, encourage folks to get certified is something that, you know, Tammy and others have been working on. But we found in a number of areas, because remember, our business is so distributed around the state, particularly in these rural areas, it's hard to find those qualified vendors. So
right.
Our agency-specific goals kind of reflect that in terms of our targets and kind of what's realistic, and we'll continue to work on it. You know, between now and the end of the fiscal year is a big push for us with respect to purchasing, and so we do have an opportunity, particularly with our spot purchases for our divisions, to really help make a push on this, and so we're going to be talking about that as a team and doing everything we can on this front. So look forward to working with all the commission on this to continue to improve per everyone's expectations.
And on behalf of staff, we appreciate your interest in what you were just saying. I was at Texas Education Agency, and just because somebody meets the qualifications to be a hub doesn't mean they're a hub. I mean, at one point we had to avail, you made an offer, and the State Board of Education had to go in and talk to some of the attorneys who were doing mediations and hearing disputes as an outsourced contract for TEA. To encourage them, we couldn't force them to go and be certified. In order to participate in the program, the vendor does have to provide sensitive personal information in order to get that certification. Right. And that's objectionable to some people, particularly lawyers and other folks who don't want their tax returns and Social Security number handed over to a governmental entity.
I'm not one of them.
We're just objectionable, period.
I gotta get on board that program myself. I'm not a lawyer, but anyway.
Any other questions, comments, or discussion? Thank you both very much. There's no further action required on that item. Committee item number 3, natural agenda, a state agency strategic plan update. Julie Horsley. Julie, please make your presentation.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Julie Horsley. I'm with the Administrative Resources Division. And this afternoon, I'll be talking to you about updates that we would like to make to our strategic plan covering the 2013 to 2017 timeframe. This plan is also known as the Natural Agenda. And I'd like to explain just a little bit about how it relates to the land and water plan that you all are familiar with. This is more of a legislative strategic plan. It outlines our funding structure and budget structure, and it identifies funding needs for the next biennium and on into the future. And we do make every effort to make sure that the two plans are consistent and that there are linkages between the two, and I'll talk to you a little bit about how exactly we plan to do that a little bit later in the presentation. I'll start off with just a little bit of background and history. The requirement for strategic planning was established by the legislature in 1991. Provisions of the government code require that all state agencies engage in strategic planning and prepare and submit a 5-year plan every 2 years. The plan has to include specific elements per statute and per instructions that are issued by the LBB and the governor's office. For example, all agency strategic plans have to include agency mission statement. They all have to have an internal and external assessment, and they all have to have goals, objectives, and strategies. And those last elements that I just mentioned are what forms the agency's budget structure and provide the framework through which we request our funding request and the legislative appropriations request. There's also some other sections in the plan, such as long-term and short-term funding needs, that kind of set the stage and provide a preview of the kinds of exceptional items that we might be requesting in the legislative appropriations request as well. In terms of due dates and processes, our process internally relies very heavily on division input as far as the changes that we're going to be making to our strategic plan. We started the process back in January, asking divisions to provide input on possible changes to structure, including strategies and performance measures. I'll be reviewing the proposals that we've received over the next couple of slides. We also have asked for divisions to provide input into other sections of the natural agenda as well, including the text of the document. As far as due dates and deadlines, these are pretty much dictated by the LBB and the governor's office. Any proposed changes to budget structure, including strategies and measures, have to be submitted sometime in April. We don't know the specific dates at this point because the instructions haven't been issued. But if we go based on what it was last time, it was around the 16th of April. Once we submit the changes to the LBB and the governor's office, there's usually a series of meetings that we have to negotiate the proposed changes. And I just wanted to point that out because final approval of the structure changes rests with those two offices. It's not something that we determine on our own. And then finally, the final plan, which incorporates the approved budget structure as well as the other changes that we have, will be due in late June or early July. And last time that was due on July 2nd, I believe. So in terms of the structure changes that we have this time around, the strategy changes that we have are not quite as extensive as they have been in prior years. Really, this time, the only changes that we have to strategies impact the communications division. Currently, we have four different strategies for the communications division, and they're listed on this slide. Hunter and Boater Education is one. The magazine is another. There's a strategy to promote and provide communications products and services, and then outreach and education programs. And the request that we'll be submitting to the LBB and governor's office is basically just to consolidate those four strategies down to two. What that would mean is that we'll roll all the outreach and education programs together into one strategy, and then the magazine would also be rolled into providing communication products and services. The measure changes that we're asking for, again, not very extensive. We're asking for addition of a total of four new measures. Two of those would be in the Wildlife Division and aimed at allowing them to better gauge the efforts in the area of prescribed burns and also to track better the efforts that they have in serving private landowners by providing a count of the number of presentations and consultations provided to that group. And then the other two measures that we're proposing to add would be in the communications division, allowing us to better track communications through various means, such as YouTube views and email subscription services. In addition to the four measures that we're adding, there's going to be some revisions to about 20 measures, but these are for the most part non-substantive, just cleanup and clarification purposes. So, as I mentioned before, in addition to the structure changes that we've been working on, divisions have been providing input into other sections of the strategic plan. For example, key events and areas of change that have impacted the agency, short and long-term funding needs. And the other section of the strategic plan that I did want to mention is strategic priorities, where we lay out our strategic priorities. And this is really where we establish that link between the natural agenda and the land and water plan. Basically, this time around, what we're going to do is use all the elements that are in the land and water plan as the strategic priorities that we set forth in the natural agenda, including the goals and objectives and the action items in the land and water plan, and providing kind of an update on our efforts towards attaining those action items in the land and water plan. We will plan to provide you with a draft of the natural agenda sometime around the next commission meeting. And once it's been circulated and we have comments from everybody and those have been incorporated, we then need to just get the approval and signature of the chairman and the executive director. And then we'll plan to submit the plan to the LBB in the governor's office by the required due date. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Lee.
Any questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Committee item number four, game stamp budget overview. Mr. Clayton Wolf, please make your presentation.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, for the record, I'm Clayton Wolf. I'm the Wildlife Division Director. And this afternoon, I'm going to give you a brief game bird stamp budget overview. You might wonder why I'm doing this. Just briefly, there's been a lot of chatter over the last several years about our fund balances and our game bird stamp funds. And within the last 6 months, as we met with our game bird partners to talk about important things like quail conservation and lesser prairie chicken conservation, we've been developing a communications package, and one of the things that our quail partners ask is that I share with this commission just some of our spending patterns and some of our revenue patterns in our game bird stamp funds, and so that's the purpose for my presentation this afternoon. Just briefly, our first game bird conservation stamp was the white-winged dove stamp, and it was issued in 1971 for $3, and then 10 years later came the waterfowl stamp, and then a few years after that, our turkey stamp. And we did some great things with these funds, conserving these species and their habitats, but as we moved into the 21st century, we began to realize that we had other game bird conservation needs out there, and the fact of the matter is we achieved some of our goals with these other species. So we need a little more comprehensive funding approach to deal with more comprehensive game bird conservation issues that were on the horizon for us. So in 2005, the Texas legislature basically revised the statutes, repealed the three previous game bird stamps, and created the upland and the migratory game bird stamps. And as far as the statutes that dictate how the agency is to spend that money, we really haven't seen many significant changes. The money still must be used for the management and research of the species or suites of species out there, and for acquisition, lease, and development of the habitats that support those species. And then things like contracts and donations, an example of a contract that would be applicable would be passing through money to DU Canada to purchase breeding grounds in Canada for the waterfowl that spend their winter down here. So the only real difference is as we made the transition into 2005 was that we included many more game bird species, and the previous statutes also required that 50% of the proceeds from the previous funds be used for acquisition, lease, and development. So no significant changes except for the mandate that 50% of the proceeds be for acquisition, lease, and development in the former statutes. So if we take a look at recent history on revenue, the revenue pattern for these game bird stamp funds, I've got on this chart here 2004 through 2011. I'll remind you that in 2005 is when the new stamp was authorized. So the first bar there is actually the revenue from white-winged dove, the waterfowl, and migratory stamps combined. And you'll see that with the authorization of the new stamps, including more species and the requirement to have that stamp to hunt those species, our revenue went up. And we've leveled off at about $5 million a year combined, with the majority of that being in the migratory stamp category. More importantly, from an operational standpoint for us, is not how much money comes in, but how much money we can spend. And so this next slide looks at the same set of years. We have parsed out the data here to show that we had balances in our previous accounts, and so we had to continue to spend those balances down. And 2011 was the first year when we actually, or in 2010, we had finally spent down the previous fund balances and the other stamp funds. And, of course, the other notable change here on the slide is in 2008, we see a significant increase in expenditures. Basically, in 2007, we were experiencing increased fund balances in our Gainbridge Dam funds, as well as many other funds that the agency had. And so the Texas legislature increased our spending authority in the Wildlife Division, got a chunk of that additional spending authority to increase our game bird conservation initiatives. And so we put that into additive products out there. We put that into habitat management on our wildlife management areas. And we significantly increased our research and management contracts. That is money that we pass out to NGOs and universities to do some of this conservation work. Something else we were recognizing at that time, and I had to go visit a little bit with Gene McCarty to get some of the history on this, but we were also recognizing that we were having a declining balance in our Fund 9, our Game, Fish, and Water Safety account. And so we were on a trajectory that we couldn't sustain with the revenue that was coming into Fund 9, and at the same time, we still had significant fund balances in our Game Bird Stamp accounts. And so in 2011, we embarked upon a new strategy, and here's where I probably should let you know that when it's been an expectation of our sportsmen, of our game bird hunters, that when they buy a hunting license, and they pay for that hunting license, and then they pay an additional fee for a game bird stamp, they're expecting some kind of added value to the purchase of that stamp specifically for that species. And that was our expectation as well. The statutes don't dictate that happened that way. But in fact, we recognize that it's a realistic expectation that as we get more funds in, we should be doing more for those species. And so as those funds came in, our projects were additive. But as I said, in 2008, 2009, as the agency was looking at our Fund 9 balances, we saw we were on a trajectory that we weren't going to be able to fund. And so all the Fund 9 divisions were to look at different strategies to deal with that. We were asked to look at utilizing game bird stamp funds to supplant some of the Fund 9 funds that were being used to fund game bird strategies. And so this was a departure from what folks normally expected. We pulled in the leadership of our upland and our migratory game bird advisory committee and sat down, visited with Carter Smith and our leadership about this strategy. As you might expect, you know, folks weren't enamored with the idea, but they did recognize that we were in a pinch on Fund 9 dollars. And so ultimately we got the concurrence not just of the leadership, but also of the combined committees to proceed forward with the strategy of taking game bird stamp funds and replacing some of those Fund 9 dollars. There was one caveat, and it was an obvious caveat that the committee brought forward, and that was that any either additive projects or any projects that we were previously funding with Fund 9, that any game bird stamp dollars that we put to that would be specific strategies that were addressed in one of our three game bird management plans. And so now what we do is we present an annual report to our game bird partners that shows how the money is spent in all the projects. This is just one page out of that report. It's a summary table, but we actually have a write-up for each of these projects, and we show the specific strategies in the game bird plans that are being funded with game bird stamp dollars. If you look on the screen there, you know, the top two or line one and line three are basically, those are projects that have always been additive. Those are dollars that we pass through to NGOs and universities. The top four lines have been those additive projects, but we also have projects down there like technical guidance and wildlife habitat assessment that previously were funded with Fund 9 dollars, and now a portion of those, 8% of one project and 19% of the other project, are funded with game bird stamp funds. But there are definitely activities that are taking place within those projects that are strategies listed in our different strategic plans. And so if we look back at this chart here and our expenditures in 2011, the take-home point is that for those combined charts or the stack bar chart there, some of those are not all additive projects. Some of that money is going into projects that were previously funded with our Fund 9 dollars. And then, of course, we had to make the transition to fiscal year 12 and 13. We know that all state agencies had to give some, and all of our divisions had to give some, and so we dealt with the budget cuts. And in addition to our personnel reductions and in addition to reducing operating across the board. We also looked at our game bird stamps, and in sum, we cut $750,000 in spending authority from our game bird stamps. The biggest part of that came from expiring contracts. Those contracts that I said in 2008 where we were adding research contracts out there, and those typically were contracts for a 2 or 3 year term. When they would expire, we would roll that money into a new contract. And so we had $621,000 in game bird stamp contracts expiring, and we chose not to renew those contracts. Additionally, we were at the time putting $200,000 a year on our WMAs for habitat enhancement projects. We reduced that by $136,000. Now, I want to make clear here, the projects are still going on out there, but we have some goods and services accounts on those WMAs for surface use agreements and pipeline easements. And so we're using that money to replace this $136,000. So in effect, we have a $136,000 in appropriation authority, but we're still getting the work done. So this is a picture. The title of this slide here is Game Bird Stamp Expenditures, but actually that last bar for fiscal year 2012 is actually our budget. It's not an accurate depiction of expenditures because we're not done, but you can see a significant reduction. If you recall the first slides that I had up there and you compare to this, you'll notice that we're spending a lot less than we're bringing in. And so if we go to my last slide here that shows Game Bird Stamp Fund balances since 2006, we've been gaining by $1 million to $2 million a year. Fiscal year 10 was probably the closest we got to slowing that down. But now with our reduced spending in these accounts, things will accelerate some. You know, I think we can expect to see $2 million a year added to this if we maintain our current spending pattern. So with that, I'll be glad to take any questions. Oh, and I might add at the end, of course, that is obviously the source of frustration, the fact that our game bird partners are buying stamps. They're expecting good things to happen. We have a long list of good things we'd like to do, but obviously we're in a situation right now where we just can't spend those, and so the funds aren't going away. They're still there and they're building, but obviously someday we'd like to get our hands on those and be able to spend them to address some of these things like the quail issues we heard about this morning.
Wait, we can't spend them because we don't have the legislative authority to spend it, is that correct?
That's correct. Now, there's no specific dedicated authority for game bird stamps. Okay. That's a game bird stamp, and Gene can jump in if I'm wrong. It's a sub-account in Fund 9. So when we get authority to spend Fund 9, we can spend Fund 9 dollars or we can spend game bird stamp dollars. So we do have a choice on where to spend those dollars. But as the budget grew through time, we were adding those special game bird projects and still doing the business we're doing with deer and endangered species and all those other technical guidance to private landowners. And so when spending authority was to be reduced some, the first logical place we looked was so that we didn't cut our core services anymore was the money that we were passing out to NGOs and universities, because we had already had gone through our reduction in force and we felt like we couldn't reduce our staff anymore. So we could theoretically We could spend that $2 million a year and just tell our staff, quit responding to requests for deer management or other things not related to game birds. But the fact of the matter is we have a diverse group of customers out there that want a lot of work, and we want to make sure that we're addressing all those needs. So it's fun. It's authority. It's not specific to game bird stamps. We do have decisions that we have to make, but at the same time, if we just went to spending our game bird stamp money on appropriate game bird projects, then we would have to stop doing some of those other projects that we traditionally do for other sportsmen.
Just because of a lack of manpower, or
it's spending authority. It's limited spending authority is the issue.
So, Commissioner, there's a total appropriation that's set. And then there's a variety of revenue streams that that the agency has to try to meet that total appropriation. What's happening is we're collecting more money from the sale of hunting and fishing licenses and stamp funds than what's appropriated. We've got to make decisions internally about what revenue stream we use to fund our programs to meet our different goals, subject to that total appropriation cap. Does that make sense?
Yep. So, okay. So, what essentially happens then is you may have an income stream from the stamps that you're not in any given year using all of the funds from that income stream.
Exactly.
You're taking some of those funds and using them to get up to your appropriated level. But then the remaining funds, I assume, remains in Fund 9?
That's right, yeah. So those funds remain in a dedicated account.
Right.
That are there for some hypothetical future expenditure consistent with the intent of those funds.
Got it.
But it's always subject to appropriation. So they're in a fund balance. They're used to certify the overall state budget, but they're just not appropriated to the agency at that time. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It doesn't make sense, but
I should have phrased it. Did you understand the explanation that I gave?
It's an accounting nightmare.
Well, it's a fact.
Yeah, right. It doesn't make sense. It's a fact. I understand the fact.
Accounting nightmare.
Any other discussion about the commission? Any other questions? Oh,
thank you.
Thanks, Clayton. Chairman Friedkin, this committee has completed its business.
Thank you. Okay, I think we've completed our committee business. I declare us adjourned. Thanks.